JB. Then I have a conic reverse way, which is one is to the right, one is to the left conic, which says Smith R plus JX. I wonder historically how was that polar evolve to the Smith chart? That's the one question. And the second question is, on 4194A impedance gain phase analyzer by Hewlett-Packard, I have rectangular as well. But this device was manufactured until 1995, if I remember correctly. What was the particular reason that they decided to keep rectangular as well? But you.
Okay, when it comes to rectangular, because it has an earlier origin, I guess some people like to represent it that way. I don't know if there's very much of an advantage. When you take a voltage that you're displaying in a polar manner, and you take a Smith chart that is displaying, a reflection coefficient, believe it or not, they are identical. The definition of everything on the chart is the same, except you set up the slanted lines in a different way. If I draw the lines a particular way, and I represent the impedance, resistive and reactive impedance, you end up with these crazy off-center circles, so to speak. It is the Smith chart. If I draw a pure polar plot, where now I'm just drawing a bunch of circles starting off at the center of the chart, the magnitude of the radius of each one of those circles represents the magnitude of the voltage, and whether or not you're drawing a line toward 12 o'clock or toward 3 o'clock represents the phase angle. You could, if you want to, take the exact same display. In other words, you've got a certain amount of the screen lit up a certain way with your signal, and you could decide to display it as a polar chart or as a Smith chart. The signal itself being displayed does not change. You're only changing the way you draw the lines on the chart itself in order to interpret them. But in the case of impedance versus admittance, let me drop it for a second. Believe it or not, assume that Mike and I have a black box, and I haven't told you what's inside. And you've got two terminals, you've got one input connector, two terminals, so to speak, ground and the hot terminal on the outside. And at your particular favorite frequency, you make a measurement. And you find out something about the impedance of what's in the box. You could, even though the box might contain 50 resistors, 14 capacitors, and 12 inductors, in some kind of a complicated arrangement, a lattice arrangement or whatever, might be a very complicated passive component. But at your particular single frequency, you make a measurement, and with good instrumentation on the outside, you can represent everything that's in that black box only at that one frequency as a simple resistor and a simple capacitor, or a simple resistor and a simple inductor. In both cases, they're in series with each other. So with two components, you can make a complete representation only at that frequency of everything that's in that box. That's if you decide to do it as a series network equivalent at that frequency. You could, if you want to, make a slightly different resistor and a slightly different value capacitor that are in parallel with each other and come up with the exact same impedance, the exact same representation of everything that's in that black box at that one frequency. But be careful. They are equivalent. When they're in parallel with each other, we call them we don't call it impedance anymore. We call it the inverse of the impedance. I keep getting the words mixed up on this one. It's G plus JB. G is conductance and JB is susceptance. So if I represent them as a parallel equivalent, it's a G plus JB equals the Y. Z becomes Y when you make them in parallel. Or the exact same circuit can be represented as a impedance where there's some resistance and
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And some amount of reactance in series with it. And so if I had three black boxes, one is the real black box with the very complicated network that Mike supplied to us in his class. The second black box is the impedance box that Dick provides to you, which has got inside of it a single resistor and a single capacitor of just the right value. And then the third box is provided by Mel, and he chose the parallel equivalent. and he chose the right resistor and the right capacitor in parallel with each other, and you got these three black boxes side by side, and at this one frequency, you measure each of the three black boxes, and you get the exact same result. And you'll say, wow, how can that be? But there's a catch. Let me warn you, when I've fallen into this trap, when you go from a series equivalent to a parallel equivalent, and there's a way you can do that with a modern-day calculator, you just press 1 over X, and it does it all for you automatically. It does the inverse for you. Or you can go through a bunch of equations that give you the inverse. They give you the other equivalent circuit. But it's only true at that frequency. You sweep the frequency, and if, for instance, you've got a capacitive reactance, as I sweep the frequency on the series circuit, the capacitive reactance goes down in a particular way. And in the case of the parallel circuit, it behaves differently. So be careful about these equivalents. The equivalents, when you form them, are only true for that particular frequency you calculated for, and you sweep to some other frequency, and the equivalency, in most cases, is lost. I know this is off to one side, but it's good information to know, in my opinion. We've come up to 9 o'clock, and maybe we should go over to your mailbag, Mel. Let me first find out, Mr. VZA, did you have a question on the subject is on the table, or do you want your name added to the list right after we go to the mailbag? Mr. VZA or something like that, give me your full call and your name, K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. The name is Glenn. Handle is November 2, Zulu Echo Alpha, and I have an unrelated question, so I'll wait till the end.
November 2, Zulu Echo Alpha. You're on the list, Glenn, and we go to the mailbag. So, Mel, what kind of burning questions have you gotten this week? K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, good evening again. This is K2KEY. Yeah, Bernie. Is a good one. In fact, you know, something that should have been covered sometimes in QST, because I guarantee this has come up and nobody has ever given a complete answer to this. My problem is I'm worried about the visual impact of my new antenna. It is a vertical, and I'd like to know if I could spray my trapped vertical, will it degrade in any way the performance of the vertical antenna? That's the point, you know? That's a good question because, you know, you get this shiny new antenna pokes up there and it reflects the sun off of it, and sooner or later somebody's going to say, what's that? You know, what is that doing there? So you got an area where, you know, they're sensitive to antennas, which seems to be coming up more and more. We won't get into that at this point, but what can we do? Can we camouflage it by dulling it down in some way, Dick, without having some kind of a detrimental effect on a multi-band vertical antenna? Over.
Hey, Mel, this is a beautiful question. I lost an awful lot of sleep over this one. In 1971, I guess it was, using a American paint can as the large portion of the horn, using a Scottish oatmeal can as the smallest portion of the horn, you go to the August issue, 1972, QST magazine. You'll see K2RIW on the front cover with this 12-foot dish, and inside you'll see the 12-foot dish that I used to listen to the Apollo astronauts. It's made out of screening and pieces of aluminum tubing bent into a parabolic shape by the bow and arrow technique with dielectric strings and the so-called stressed parabolic dish antenna. Okay, I made this exotic feed horn for this thing to operate at the Apollo astronaut command module frequency, 2287.5 megacycles. And because these cans were, they started off with paint on them, in order to solder them together, I had to scrape away the paint, and then I wanted to repaint the cans with silver spray paint, Rust-Oleum silver spray paint. Let me drop it. And I knew that I'm listening to an extremely weak signal from the astronauts, a 10-watt transmitter, a quarter of a million miles away. Everything had to be just right, a good low-noise preamplifier, high-efficiency antenna, no losses anywhere. The antenna itself had to have a simple main lobe with no strong side lobes, looking at hot Earth. I had to do everything just right, otherwise I knew I was not going to get that signal, because here I am with a 12-foot dish in Farmingdale trying to listen to the astronauts, where NASA is using a 240-foot diameter dish in Goldstone, California, just to make sure they've got really good reliability when they're on the Omni antenna, and I knew that I'd only be get enough signal from them when they were using the high-gain antenna, the astronauts at the moon, and so I calculated that I would have a couple of dB to spare. I knew I had to do it just right, and so I wanted to spray it with Rust-Oleum silver paint in order to make the feed horn look good, and I really worried about, am I going to create an extra loss that I can't account for? And I did a bunch of measurements, and I couldn't find any excess loss. I said, what in the world's going on? I know this paint is a yucky, non-conductive material. I'm spraying it on top of this can. I'm using it at a nice high. In those days, I thought this was a super high frequency, 2,800 megacycles. I just knew I had to be 2,300 megacycles. I knew I had to be very careful to do things right. Well, a few years later, I finally figured out what's going on. Let me drop it. And that is, think of the inverse problem. If you're designing an anechoic chamber, you start off with a real good shielded screen room to make sure that no signals get in from the outside. That's the good news. You can make a good shielded six-sided box out of a double thickness of copper screening with nice finger stocks on the door and whatever, and nice feed-through networks. So now you've got a real good isolated screen room. And do it correctly, you can have at least 100 decibels of shielding. Now you're going to put your antennas or whatever under test inside, and you don't want the signal bouncing around in the screen room like it does inside of a microwave oven. Otherwise, it makes all those echoes, so to speak, will disturb the living daylights out of your measurements. So you want to coat the inside surface of your screen room with what's called anechoic material. That's a Greek word that means no echo. So you're going to coat it with stuff that's going to absorb all the signals so that there is no echo. So you're going to fool the antenna to think it's in the middle of free space, halfway between the Earth and the Moon, so to speak, real free space. All signals get sent out, never come back. That's the way you want your screen room to act. Now you start digging into how you design anechoic material. And the bottom line is you're going to use just the right resistivity of stuff with just the right shape, and in general, it is going to be at least a wavelength thick if you want significant absorption, and maybe beyond a wavelength, like 2, 3, 4 wavelengths if you can think about it. So if absorption, when you use just the right stuff and you're intentionally trying to make loss, you're intentionally trying to make absorption, let me drop. It takes a significant portion of a wavelength to do it if you're doing it with simple resistive materials. I will admit that there's some very exotic materials where you have just the right ratio of magnetic materials and resistive materials. It's called MagRAM, magnetic loaded radar absorbent material, MagRAM. Well, that's very expensive, very frequency selective tuned, an exotic material. You and I are not going to use that. If you're using ordinary dielectric and resistive materials that you can get out of a paint can, and if you want it to have a whole lot of loss, you can't do it with a 0.01 wavelength of thickness. That paint that I was putting on that can was probably a half or a quarter of a thousandth of an inch thickness, and I'm doing it at a wavelength of 4.5 inches. No way in hell could that absorb it, no matter what I use, no matter how exotic the material. I couldn't make it lossy enough that I could measure a difference. If I now get down to 30 megacycles to 7 megacycles on your vertical ground plane antenna, and you're going to coat it with something, and you think that the radio wave is going to get absorbed by that something, but that stuff is going to be a thousandth of an inch thick. If you use really good 4 coats of real thick house paint, maybe you can get 3 or 4 thousandths of an inch thick. 3 or 4 thousandths of an inch thick at a 40-meter wavelength. Can you see how big that ratio is? No way in hell can that have any loss that you can measure, with one exception. If the paint is on the connector, on the spade lug, where you're going to screw it down, and you want the ground lug of the antenna to make good contact to the shield of the coax cable feed line that's feeding the antenna, yeah, paint in that area, which will show up with your ohm meter real fast as a non-contact, that's going to kill the antenna. But any paint that you and I can put on that antenna, if the smartest guys from the Kings County Radio Club chose the best
repeater, timeout, cancel,
chose brand A, B, C, and brand Z of paint that they can buy in any store on planet Earth, and they're going to coat it onto your antenna, and they want to make radio loss. They couldn't do it, Mel. Stop worrying. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, if
I've been thinking about it also. First of all, let me make a comment here. Standing behind you, a stress parabolic. 1972, Dick. First time we ever shook hands. You were the tall guy with black hair, skinny, thin guy, and I was the guy with the blonde hair. I think things have changed a little bit since 1972. All right. Question. There are paints. I know there are paints out there that contain, graphite, carbon, and other, oxides, metallic flakes, and all that kind of stuff. I guess that's what you'd have to do. Read the can and avoid those type of paints. Correct? Over.
Using good common sense, you're right. In reality, the answer is no, Mel. If I chose any brand of paint that you can find with carbon granules in it, and I'm going to lay down a hundredth of a wavelength or a thousandth of a wavelength of thickness of that paint, you would have great difficulty measuring any difference in performance with that antenna. If you're using only simple resistive materials, carbon granules and metal chips or whatever, simple resistive materials, until you get a substantial portion of a wavelength, at least a quarter of a wavelength thick, you're not going to measure any reasonable amount of change in performance. The slight exception to that is this exotic material called MagRAM, magnetically loaded radar absorbent material. If you've got just the right ratio of lossy magnetic material and lossy resistive material, and you get just the right ratio and just the right thickness with a metallic backing, you can now make a MagRAM material that will have substantial absorption. You are simulating 377 ohms of free space. Ordinarily, if I had a sheet of plastic and I take your resistive material and I lay it on there, and I want to make the material as lossy as possible, let me show you the second way you try to do this, the inverse problem. Let me drop. I want to get the maximum absorption by taking a thin sheet of plastic, and I'm now going to paint resistive material on there. And I'm going to paint design 1 through 3 through 1,000. I got all kinds of paint designs. And each of the paints have got a different amount of loaded resistor material inside. This, by the way, is called scrim material. You can buy something that looks like the sheer curtains that you put on your house that have been dumped in Aquadag. They've been dumped in a solution that's got carbon granules in it and some kind of a binder. And when you take this this sheer material out of the fluid and dry it, you can now make material that is 100 ohms per square, 200 ohms per square, 1,000 ohms per square. You're setting the resistivity of this, what they call scrim material, stands for scrimshaw, scrim material. You can make this material that you can do with various kinds of antenna experiments, and you can make it various impedances. And now you want to make the resistive material have the maximum absorption, and you'll find out it's 189 ohms. If you go lower than 189 ohms, it doesn't absorb anymore, it reflects. You go higher than 189 ohms, it doesn't absorb anymore, the signal goes flying through there. At 189 ohms is where you get the maximum absorption with a simple resistive sheet of material. Let me drop. To which you're going to say, why isn't it 377? Mother Nature's got a couple of tricks up her sleeve here. 189 ohms, when you put it in free space, does give you maximum absorption. 377 ohms, it does give you some absorption, but you've got the 377 ohms of your sheet of material. Mother Nature is always supplying 377 ohms of apparent impedance of free space. And those two things, the free space and your sheet of material, are in parallel with each other. You didn't realize it, but when you put a piece of 377 ohm material in space, you have created a 189 ohm resistive network in that area of space, because the free space is in parallel with your sheet of material, and you don't get maximum absorption when you do that. However, when you've got just the right ratio of magnetic material and resistive material, you can make a sheet of material that does look like 377 ohms, but it takes a very exotic, expensive way of doing it. You're not going to hit that by mistake. You can't buy that in any hardware store, Home Depot, or I can't even think of the name of the other major store that sells these kind of things. So, stop worrying. paint it with anything you want, any color you want. I don't care if there's carbon granules in the paint. You can't make it glossy enough that you'll see a difference at the thicknesses that you're able to lay down. If I wanted to lay down a quarter wavelength at 40 meters, that would be 10 meters of thickness of paint. That's not very likely in my book, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
KC2QIQ.
Mel first, and then we're going to go over to Glenn. I wonder if that's a bit of a surprise to you, Mel. Over to you, Mel first.
Not really. I had a feeling that you were most likely weren't going to have much of an effect on it. Because the antennas here get coated with a lot of corrosion at times, you know, because it's all there. I've had the beams down here. I figured, oh, boy, that, you know, it's detrimental to the way they're working. Polish the beams up. They used to, in fact, if I want to really go back to the days, they used to have a thing that was actually sold and advertised in a magazine called Antenna Wax. This is really old-timer stuff that you put on the elements, and it sort of kept them nice and shiny and all. Oh, it proves the efficiency of your beam, your antenna, which is, of course, a lot of baloney. But all right. The only thing, of course, I could say that, maybe when we get into UHF, go up to a gig, I guess maybe some coatings, like you say, could be detrimental, Dick. All right, let me turn it back to you. We'll pick up the next question. First, pick up Glenn. Go ahead, Dick.
By the way, on the front cover of August 1972 QST magazine, where I'm standing on that picnic table holding that dish during the antenna gain measurement, and one of the guys in the foreground is Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, who is measuring those, I should know this after all these years. Is one of the other guys in that picture K2KEY? Over to you, Mel.
Okay, if I remember correctly, God, where was I standing? Yes. I'll never forget, because my friend Joe was standing, I think, in front of me. He's a silent key now. And I was looking over his shoulder to the left of you, Dick. Over.
Okay, therefore, are you in that picture? You've seen that front cover of that QST magazine, August 1972. Are you? You and I didn't yet know each other. Boy, if we only knew what the future held. Oh. You would have walked away. Okay. To your knowledge, is your face, even a portion of it, in that picture, Mel? Go ahead.
Sir, look at me looking over the shoulder of Joe. If you look to the, if you've got that picture, I remember distinctly, I said, I only got a little bit, part of my head into this picture. And we shook hands, but there were so many people around, Dick, that I only got to say, you know, fantastic. Somebody made a quick comment to you about how lovely this thing looks. So that's it. If you look in the picture, you got the original picture. I got it somewhere here, a blow-up of it, and you'll see Joe is standing. Let me see. He was standing to, let me see. The picture was taken to the left of you, and I was looking, like, over his shoulder trying to, observe what was going on. Over.
When you say, look at the original, I am holding in my hand the printing press plate that literally printed that front cover 180,000 issues. I'm holding on to that printing press plate because it was given to me because that article was selected as one of the good articles in that particular magazine. I see a total of three human beings there. Dick Turin to the right of me as you look at the picture, me holding onto the dish, standing on the antenna, standing on the table, and another guy with nearly blonde hair to the left. I'm going to have to look at the picture more closely with a magnifying glass to see if that's K2KEY. Now, the original picture, the original 35-millimeter slide done on Panatomic X film, there's a little bit more to it. I'm going to have to go back and look at it, Mel, to see if you're there. Interesting. What a bit of history. These two guys are eventually going to meet together and spend all kinds of hours together. Wow. Who knew? Glenn, you've got it. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thank you. N2Z Echo Alpha. I need to remount a printed circuit board with what appears to be like a silicon rubber kind of substance. And I want to know what I can use that's not going to be corrosive or acidic or destroy the board. Can I use a regular water-based latex, or does it have to be an oil-based silicon rubber?
Glenn, I'm sorry. I created a, The guy who signed in with a comment was Glenn KC2QIQ, and I didn't make that clear. I'm sorry. And because of my absent-mindedness, I couldn't think of QIQ's call letters right away. We're going to get to your question, Glenn, right after we finish with the mailbag. Glenn KC2QIQ, go right ahead with your comments.
Good evening, Dick. I can see this is going to get confusing now with two Glens on here. You're going to have to say my call now. But, no, I was just talking about, you brought up a point of a material that has always been a kind of a mystery to me, talking about, absorptive materials at microwaves. And one of them that comes to mind is Echosorb. And that material has always kind of fascinated me because it is an iron and epoxy mixture. I wouldn't quite call it ferrite, but it's definitely like epoxy and iron, and it has some very, very interesting properties. But the way it absorbs, from my understanding of it, was that it actually causes like wave scattering and really does an interesting job where it really only has to be a fraction of the wavelength and still get very, very good absorptive characteristics. But it's such an odd material that, I don't think any kind of paint would ever have that kind of property. Back to you, Dick. KC2QIQ.
Okay, we've got an ambiguity going on here. The Emerson Cummings Company, for a whole lot of years, was one of the world's major manufacturers of anechoic material, pyramid-shaped anechoic material, to be used on the walls of an anechoic chamber. Emerson Cummings Echosorb AN75 is a very popular material that I use every day. Alpha November-75. Happens to be a flat sheet, but there's other variations of it with about five layers to it, six layers of various resistivities that are very carefully matched to be a binomial taper distribution, or is it I think it's a binomial taper. Anyhow, the Echosorb material is a urethane foam, the normal material, the most popular material, the least expensive high-performance material. Is pyramid in shape. It's a polyurethane foam resistively loaded with carbon granules. And the majority of the absorption takes place because they've got just the right resistivity. And the pyramidal shape does something really magic. In order to absorb a signal completely, remember I told you with the Scrimshaw material, where it's a very thin sheet of nearly zero thickness in wavelengths, and you can set the resistivity of the material, ohms per square, anything you want, from nearly zero to nearly infinity, and you'll find out that maximum absorption takes place at 189 ohms per square, and that's not 377 ohms. Turns out that any simple thin sheet of resistive material is simultaneously reflective as well as absorptive. It cannot be a pure absorber. Let me drop. It cannot be a pure absorber unless you slowly taper that wave into it. The AN75, the really thick, or is it AN79, the really thick material that goes down to 1 gig, consists of six separate layers of foam. And if you stick your ohm meter into each of those six layers edgewise, you'll find out the forward layer is very high in ohms, something like 1,000 ohms per square, and the next one is maybe 800, and then 300, and so on. It tapers in a very funny way, and then the back layer is a very low resistive material. You're slowly tapering that signal. It's very similar to a Minerva line. If I take a twin lead cable of 300 ohms square, 300 ohms impedance, and I slowly move those two wires closer together, and I do it over a number of wavelengths, I will end up with a impedance taper device that's broadband, it can work over multiple octaves, and it has no reflection, and I can taper 300 ohms down to 50 ohms if I want to. In other words, you can do some great things within the RF world if you do it as a slow taper. So that's true in case of a coaxial cable or a twin lead type transmission line where you're slowly tapering the dimensions to slowly taper the impedance. It's the world's best kind of a balancing device or impedance matching device, but it takes real estate to do it. And the same thing happens in free space. You've got to slowly taper. Let me drop. So if you're doing it with flat sheets, you have to hand select the individual six layers so that they match a particular binomial taper equation if you want to get maximum absorption for that level of thickness. And any other ratio doesn't give you as much absorption, you won't get as much performance. The other way you can do the taper is the pyramid shape. Picture a flat wall, a vertical wall, with these pyramids sticking out toward you. You've glued the anechoic material, the Echozorb AN75, you've glued it against the wall, and the pyramids are aiming toward you, and now you've got this RF wave as a flat sheet of RF, the forward zero phase angle of the signal that you're transmitting, that came from a long distance away, that's why it's flat, and as that flat sheet of RF starts hitting those pyramids, it hits all the tips of the pyramids first. So if I'm doing a slow motion movie, and I'm keeping track of that most forward surface, that flat surface of the RF energy penetrating at a normal angle into those pyramids, you'll see these little sharp square points of the pyramids starting to pierce your material, and as your wave penetrates deeper and deeper into the pyramids, the sheet that you're looking at in your animation will have these square holes getting larger and larger. It's a slow taper. They're doing it there by way of shape, and that's the best way to do it. So in order to really absorb RF in the free space of a transmission line, in a TEM transmission line, or in free space of 70 ohms per square, you got to do it with a slow taper, or you got to use the exotic material to simulate 377 ohms of free space. If you don't do that, you're going to get a lot more reflection than absorption. I wonder if that makes some sense. Glenn number one, KC2QIQ, K2RW, go ahead, Glenn.
And let the commercial go through. Yeah, no, it is interesting, Dick. I was well aware of those pyramid shapes that were being used in the anechoic chambers in the free space. But it's not as clear to when you're using like Echozorb in like small little flat sections. When you tape it or glue it to the bottom of a cover, and you put it on inside like a small enclosure. And they tend to really quiet things up sometimes. And, I've seen it used in a lot of applications, especially where you have, EMI type of things or high gain stages in, like, amplifiers that are all, like, closed in a can. A lot of times you see little pieces of glue to the top. And, I'm not sure it's really as clear of how it's exactly working. Certainly the pyramid shapes, that's a lot more clear, but the very, very thin material, and obviously that doesn't share any of the characteristics of paint and how that's working, but that one, maybe if you could add a few more words to that one, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think Emerson Cumming has created a bit of a ambiguity here. A number of their products are called Echozorb, absorbs echo. The original materials are polyurethane foam with resistive loaded Comet granules soaked into the foam, and then they paint it with blue paint on the outside and make it look really pretty. Then they have a whole bunch of other materials with a different product number on them, a different serial number, so to speak. And some of these are these, let me think now, what color is it? Is it brown or is it gray?
It's brown.
It's a brown, rubbery-like material. That is the real MagRAM. That stuff is, you said it's loaded with metal chips, and you're absolutely right. That has lossy magnetic material as well as resistive material at just the right ratio to simulate 377 ohms, and it works best when it has a metallic backing. And that material is very thin wavelength-wise. And many of those materials are only about an eighth inch, quarter inch thick, and they do a very good absorbing job. But that stuff is quite expensive. It is specialized at a particular frequency. In other words, if you buy the material that has the best performance at 5.6 gigahertz, for instance, you may like its performance between 3 and 8 gigahertz, but you go out of that region and it starts behaving very poorly. So it is specifically tuned to a particular frequency and is specifically tuned to 377 ohms by the right ratio of magnetic particles and resistive particles in this rubbery material. And almost nobody will coat an anechoic chamber with that. Although it would work rather well at that particular frequency, the chamber would cost you $50 million, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet. And do you want a little more explanation as to how that stuff works? Is that what you're asking? Over to you first, Glenn.
Well, I was just, I guess the way it was explained to me was that it was magnetic scattering, you know, electromagnetic scattering, that basically instead of needing the absorption over a certain, you know, wavelength, that it actually winds up by creating the signal almost like a canceling, like you said, like an absorptive impedance, by actually taking the electromagnetic signal and scattering it in such a way that it loses any kind of like phase and amplitude vector in the material. And it, like you said, it works very, very good, but it has to be against a metal back, like a ground plane. If it's against the ground plane, it works, but if it's in free space, it does nothing. So it's really kind of interesting that it has to be glued to the back. But I didn't want to take up too much time because I know Mel wants to go. Mel wants to go in with the mailbag. Maybe we can pick it up later on and pick up everybody else first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the simple explanation of scattering doesn't quite do it, Glenn. If I built a thing against a metallic wall and I want to scatter the signal, the way RF works, if I give it a watt of material and I scatter it, I still have a watt of signal going somewhere. I may be able to re-aim it in some other direction, but it's still a watt. And in the case of your six-sided closed can, your enclosure where your amplifier is in there, and the amplifier is unstable because of the way the signals are reflecting off the wall, and I so-called scatter that signal in some other angle, it's still going to reflect off those six walls. It's still going to get back to your circuit like a microwave oven, and it's going to give you grief. You can't scatter. It is a quasi-scatter-like function in the thickness of the material. If you go to the right chapter of the radar handbook, Skolnick Radar Handbook, under the chapter on absorbing materials or stealthy aircraft-type functions, they have something called the Jawman material, and there's another material. If you can make the material a quarter wave thick of just the right resistivity with a metal backing, yes, you can create a kind of a cancellation at that one frequency at a normal incident angle. This stuff that you may call Echozorb, and maybe it really is, but it's one of the more exotic materials, much higher cost, and a different product number. It really is magnetically loaded radar-absorbing material. It really is MagRAM, and it's got just the right ratio of magnetic lossy material and resistive lossy material in that particular thickness with the metal backing, and you glue that to the cover of your unstable amplifier. In many cases, it'll make it beautifully stable, and that stuff works like a charm, and it's primarily absorption. At the microscopic level within the rubbery... At the microscopic level within the rubbery material itself, a kind of microscopic scattering is taking place. I'm going to give you that. But if you look at it throughout its whole quarter inch or eighth of an inch of thickness and you stand back from it, it is purely absorptive. And if it does anything but absorb, if it does any other kind of scattering, guarantee you're going to be unhappy in your particular small six-sided enclosure that you're trying to make that amplifier more stable. That's a bunch of opinions on my part, as you can tell, Glenn. Mel, I know we got a little bit off subject, but lots and lots of guys have worried about painting. When it comes to using a steel wool on your antennas to shine them up, physically to your eye, it looks prettier, and you think you're going to get more performance. Probably not. And by the way, when you scrape your aluminum elements with steel wool, let me drop. On the surface, you're creating a steel-aluminum compound, which is not necessarily very conductive, and it tarnishes real quick and starts looking very ugly. If you scrape it with Scotch-Brite, a kind of ceramic material that doesn't have metal to it, it does a better job. But all of these surface cleaning and spraying it with Krylon or whatever to your eye makes it look prettier. In real RF performance, with laboratory equipment, you would have great difficulty measuring a difference in performance. Not too different from when a guy decides to build his 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge household wire, and he asks the question, if I leave on the rubber insulation, will the antenna not work as well? And the answer, leave on the rubber insulation if you're willing to tolerate the extra weight and the extra wind load, and you want to protect your copper inside from to slow down the rate at which it tarnishes and makes copper oxide. Those are your choices. But the RF signal itself, goes through that outer rubber coating, which is a 0.001 wavelength thick. It doesn't even see it. And it goes through that rubber coating down until it sees the real metal, and then the wave does its thing. So with a couple of rare exceptions, like the square loop Yagi antenna by K6YMB, I think it's called, that is Wayne Overbeck, the Quaggy antenna. And whether or not the guys in Europe use their particular brand of 14-gauge household wire, which is some number of millimeters, with a slightly different thickness of rubber coating, and therefore the square loop driven element of this 432 megacycle Yagi tunes a little bit differently. Other than that rare case, whether you leave the rubber on or not, it doesn't matter. And by the same token, whether you leave the aluminum oxide on the outside, as long as you're not trying to make contact to it, doesn't make any difference. Shine it up any way you want to, paint it any way you want to, do anything you like to make.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Do anything you like to make it aesthetically pleasing. But radio-wise, you're not doing anything. You're pouring a cup of water into the ocean and trying to measure the difference in the tide, if you know what I mean. K2KEY, that's a bunch of opinions. K2RIW in the TechNet. Go to the next one if you want to, Mel.
Okay, yeah, I wanted to make the team look real nice again, you know. I redid the tower that time with the new guys and repainted the tower with Rust-Oleum and an aluminum coat over it, so it shines, so everything's very impressive. Looking up, it's all brand new, so that's about all. I didn't expect better performance because of, I should say, the aesthetic. All right, here's one more. Here we go. Another good vertical antenna. I have to move, and in my location, my previous location, I live with a nice backyard, and I had my Pushcraft R7 multi-band vertical antenna. Now I've moved into a place where I can't put the antenna in the backyard, can't put it anywhere. However, in this condo, guess what? I found they have an attic. Can I take the vertical and put it horizontal? Okay, he wants to change the vertical to a horizontal. Can he just stick the R7 now into the attic? Then what will happen, over?
Yeah, that's a goodie. If the attic was thoroughly radio transparent, and therefore your normal vertical antenna with its ground plane radials has just been rotated 90 degrees, then yes, broadside to the antenna, except for the fact that you're transmitting a horizontal signal instead of a vertically polarized signal, in theory you would get the exact same gain in the broadside angles. But now, off the tips of that antenna, you've got a null. And so, ordinarily, when you set it up vertical, it is an omnidirectional antenna. Not isotropic, but omnidirectional. It transmits all compass angles at once. North, south, east, west. North, northeast, north, northwest, and so on. Transmits to all angles a vertically polarized signal. And you lay it on its side. It's a horizontal signal. It favors the broadside angles. And it doesn't favor the collinear angles. That's one factor. But there's another couple of factors. When you take that antenna and you put it inside of the rafters and everything else and the sheeting that's on the roof of the house, there's a lot of near-field dielectric materials detuning the antenna. But worse than that, your attic to your eye looks like a great big open space. But now start thinking like that radio wave, where that radio wave is a great big wide thing. And it's going to look at all of that BX and Romex cabling that's in the attic, the ductwork for the air conditioning. It's going to see a lot of other metallic objects, and it's going to see the dielectric loading of the rafters and all of the wood and the shingles and everything else above it. And on a rainy day when those things are wet, all of this is going to create a slight degradation of performance. It's not a showstopper. If you are really dealing with a very tough landlord or superintendent of the building, and he really won't allow you to put up any kind of an invisible antenna, there's a bunch of ways you can do that outside. You get a lot more performance if you can put the antenna outside. but it's not a complete showstopper if you've got to put it inside. But just, I'm letting you know ahead of time that the antenna will be partially detuned. There's ways of compensating it, and the pattern is going to be degraded in that you'll have no signal that's off the ends. You're on the air, but at slightly degraded performance from my point of view. I bet some of your guys at Kings County have done things like this. Is that true, Mel? And maybe you've done it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, not me personally. However, in recalling, now I may be wrong. Somebody on frequency maybe can correct me. The R7, the Cushcraft R7 vertical, is not a quarter wave antenna requiring a ground plane. Am I correct, or maybe I'm wrong, Dick? But that's going to have a lot of difference, going to create a different situation. First of all, am I correct? Does anyone know if I'm correct about the R7? Over.
You're correct, Mel. It's an electrical half wave. It has 7 4-foot counterpoise radios. I have the R8, which came after it. Same antenna.
Okay, go ahead, Dick.
The fact that it is a half-wave electronic antenna instead of quarter wave makes feeding it a lot easier. It means that the counterpoise requirements are drastically decreased. You're starting to move in the direction of a so-called end-fed ZEP antenna, which has essentially no counterpoise that your eye can see, because you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance when you feed the outer edge of a half-wave electronic resonator that is the radiator. That's the good news. So the ground plane radials are less restrictive on that antenna, and that helps. But still, the radiator itself is properly tuned on each of its bands when it is essentially in free space, in air, and you put it into an attic where within a very small fraction of a wavelength you've got a lot of dielectric materials in the form of all of those rafters and sheeting and shingles. That's on above. Below, you've got the joists and insulation and the ceiling tiles and all of the wiring that's in the attic and all of the ductwork. So there is, without a doubt, going to be some electronic tuning. It's not a showstopper. And if you want the highest of performance, there are ways of retuning it in that environment. And even if it does get retuned, because of a antenna tuner you may be using, you can bring it back into 90-some-odd% of its performance. But you are going to have some impact because of the house that you're putting inside of and all of the nearby materials. I would go and do it if I had that restrictive landlord or supervisor to the building. I would go and do it. I worry a little bit about the fact that if the antenna is in the attic right above the neighbor's television set, there is a chance he's going to get some television interference. I'd be kind of careful to try to locate it above my apartment as opposed to above the neighbor's apartment to try to minimize that effect. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No TBI now with UHF, cable, and digital, S2EO.
Yeah, no TBI meaning they don't know what it is. They don't hear the audio anymore. But I'll warn you that if the person is using over-the-air television reception, like Mel and I are doing, there is definite TBI. If anything, the new digital system is a little more vulnerable than the analog system used to be. The good news, though, is that 98% of the population is on some kind of a cable-like system, and therefore they are very well shielded. And therefore, unless your neighbor is one of the kooky persons like Mel and I that do over-the-air television reception, they should be in pretty good shape. Over to you, Mel.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn number one.
Yeah, I had an R7, and before I went to the beams and everything else, this was about 5 years ago. And what's interesting is that that antenna, in order to get it to match, it really had to be far away from it. It had to be like mounted in position and stay far away, because anything nearby it really confused the heck out of the matching on that antenna. The other thing that I had a problem with that antenna was that, yeah, it would tune up and it worked pretty darn well. But my goodness, TBI generator, the kind of TBI that I was getting was interference was coming with, like, through computer speakers, telephone systems, and not just my house, neighbors that were next door. That's a crazy antenna. I mean, if it's the only choice you have, I'd go with it, but I would
probably rather go with a dipole or something else, but there again, that's just my opinion, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me have a couple more words on this one, Glenn. I will admit, because of a less than full-size counterpoise, that the transmission line is going to do a little bit of the radiating on that R7 antenna. But the whole purpose of the antenna is to send out a signal, and to send out that signal efficiently. And if the signal is coming out of that antenna efficiently and aimed at the horizon, and your neighbor happens to be on that horizon, they're going to intercept that signal. So can you blame it on the antenna that the television interference existed? I mean, if you want to change the radiation pattern of an omnidirectional antenna so that the adjacent neighbor doesn't get television interference, what in the world pattern would you do that still had 100% efficiency? You can see the challenge on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, this is what I found with that antenna. I wound up calling up Laird Technologies. They're the people who took over Cushcraft, the manufacturers of it. And, you know, speaking with their apps guy over there, and what he basically suggested was that antenna's design is to be mounted at ground level. In other words, you don't want to even really put it up on your roof. You want to put it, like, in the backyard, you know, with maybe less than 5 feet of pipe directly into the ground and then mount it that way. And it does perform excellent. I've even experimented with, you know, like taking it to remote locations and just, you know, put a pipe in the ground and then just attach it to it and was able to do some, like, remote operation. But, like, in a home QTH to elevate it much off of ground, that antenna has some really, really strange matching issues that it just creates a very, very strange pattern. And I had neighbors that were just calling me like every other day. They knew I was turning on as soon as I did. Once I started transmitting, they could hear it over their cordless phones. All kinds of terrible things were happening. It would set off their alarm system. It would disconnect their alarm, and all of a sudden they would their alarm would go off. It was horrible. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, did you switch over to some other antenna which allowed you to be equally as loud on the air when you talk to your ham radio friends, but that new antenna no longer interfered with that neighbor? And if so, what kind of an antenna was that? Was this when you were living in Florida? Over to you, Glenn.
No, this is in New York, Dick, here in Long Island. And basically what I did was when I switched over to an MA5B beam, and I was just using it originally in horizontal polarization. Eventually, I have a second rotator on it, so I can control polarization on it, too. But once I went to that antenna with the balun mounted in the center and balanced everything out, all those problems went away. But with that vertical, once I had it up on the roof, I mean, it performed great. It had a great takeoff angle, everything else, but, oh, my goodness. As it, just even to get it to match, you know, you had to be so far away from that antenna. You know, you do, especially when it was up in the air. When it was on the ground, it was very, very, it wasn't finicky. In other words, you could really adjust it, and, you know, you could be within 10, 15 feet of it, and you wouldn't see much change in the VSWR. But the minute you lifted it up in the air and tried to mount it on, like, some kind of a roof mount or a pipe mount somewhere off the ground, boy, was it got tricky.
Okay, you flipped over to a beam, a Yagi, and the problem disappeared. If you aimed the beam at that neighbor, would they get bombed?
No, Dick, believe it or not, I've got loop antennas, wire antennas in the backyard. I was experimenting even with fan dipoles, inverted Vs. Never had that kind of problem. And even when I had it mounted on the ground, I didn't have the problem. It was the minute I put that antenna up in the air, wow, it was just... And the bands that really give me trouble was 10 meters. Oh, my goodness. It would almost instantly knock off alarms, telephones, come through computer speakers, everything. And if you looked at the match at the antenna and the end of the feed cable, it looked like 50 ohms. It was a beautiful match on 10 meters.
Boy, there's a lot of mystery to be investigated on that one, Glenn. That's a complicated case. And that one defies normal logic. You want the antenna to radiate. If it radiates, your hams hear the signal. And in the process of radiation, if you've got a vulnerable neighbor, there's no way you can notch them out in that particular direction. So, as you can tell, I'm a little bit confused by this one. Mel, what's your take on this? K2KEY, K2RIW?
The only thing I can account for it is the so-called radiation angle. Because if you take this vertical and you're going to flip it sideways, your radiation angle is going to be most likely a higher takeoff radiation angle. let's see. If you take it and you polarize, I'm trying to... the antenna becomes horizontal, so it's going to be polarized when mounted this way as such. Let's see. It should have a high off the ground to achieve low angle. It should be, in other words. So you will probably find that because of the higher angle, yep, it definitely will most likely now become a higher angle radiating element. And could be that that low takeoff angle, when he had it ground mounted, that could be his culprit, Dick, because it's, when he put the beams up, of course, I'm sure he didn't ground mount them over.
No, ground mounted was the best performance. Up in the air is where it had the trouble. That's where that R7 had a lot of trouble.
Yeah, that is strange. The nice thing about a vertical antenna is that when you reflect a signal that's vertically polarized off the ground, the signal reflects at a grazing angle at essentially the same phase angle as what goes in. It doesn't have the 180 degrees of phase reversal. Therefore, a well operating, a good operation of a vertically polarized ground plane-like antenna is capable of sending out the signal, a pretty strong signal on the horizon, low angle of radiation, which gives you the best DX most of the time. Whereas a horizontally polarized antenna, horizontally polarization signal, reflects off the ground, experiences 180 degrees of phase reversal, which always gives you a partial null on the horizon, and depending on how many wavelengths it is above the ground, determines what is your major vertical elevation pattern. And when the antenna is a small number of wavelengths off the ground, it becomes a so-called Nevis antenna. NVIS, near vertical incident sky wave. If the antenna is a small fraction of a wavelength above the ground and horizontally polarized, the majority of the signal goes straight up. And that's good if you want to do some, if the ionosphere will support that bounce and you want to talk to somebody close by, you know, half a state away, a Nevis antenna is the way to do it. So there will be some definite changes when you take that R7 and mount it horizontal in the attic. It's not a showstopper. But knowing ahead of time that the performance is going to be slightly degraded for a bunch of these factors, and some of it can be compensated, is good to know ahead of time. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, sounds kind of unusual. What the heck went on there with this antenna? All right, with Glenn's situation. Yeah, okay, I guess antennas have a mind of their own at some time. Okay, let's go on with the TechNet, Dick. That's it for the mailbox tonight, 10 o'clock.
Okay, let's go to Glenn number two. Sorry we had to keep you so waiting so long, Glenn, but we've made everyone the promise that when they sign in the beginning of the net, that we make a heroic effort to handle everybody at least with a brief answer during the first hour, so that those people who sign in early don't have to wait the whole hour to get an answer, or wait multiple hours, because this TechNet goes on for 4 hours. Crazy people. N2, Zebra Echo Alpha. Hope you're still there, Glenn, number two. K2RIW, please repeat your question. We can hear it now. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, thank you. N2ZEA. I'm trying to mount a PC board with some what appears to be silicon-based rubber. I had to take some of the old stuff off to repair the board, and I want to reattach it now. What kind of silicon rubber can I use? Does it have to be oil-based, or can it be latex water-based? Something that won't corrode the board. Over.
You did say remount the board. It implies that it was mounted with some kind of silicone rubber to begin with. The so-called Silastic products, which are a room vulcanized curing rubbery material, there's about 10 different formulas, and some of those formulas do and do not contain a mild acid which helps it to remove the grease from the surface and give you a better bond. If it's just a mechanical mounting you require for the PC board, some people have found some very effective mountings by way of fiber washers and screws and things like that, and a piece of fish paper in there. Mechanical mounting works very well. Epoxy glue works very well. You go to a hobby shop and you can buy a 5-minute, 20-minute, whatever, two-part epoxy glues that'll do